Welcome, this is Poetry on the Move. In this episode, a panel on poetry and process recorded at the Poetry on the Move Festival held in Canberra in 2019. How do poets make their work original, moving, and incisive? How do they overcome limitations and explore what is possible in poetry? How do they innovate in their work? In this panel, a group of national and internationally regarded poets answer some deep questions on how they do what they do. We begin with Judith Beveridge. Judith Beveridge lives in Sydney. Her seventh collection of poetry, Sun Music, New and Selected Poems, was published by Girimondo in 2018. Her previous volumes have won a number of prizes, including the New South Wales, Victorian and Queensland Premier's Poetry Awards, the Grace Levin Poetry Prize, and the Wesley Michael Wright Prize.
So process. I'm fascinated by poets' processes, any writer's process, really. Remember very fondly those Paris Review books, Writers at Work. Always very inspiring and very instructive. As for myself, I've always written very slowly. I think that's just part of my nature or something. I don't think I could ever write a poem quickly. And I very rarely start with a concept or an idea for a poem. So in other words, I don't really know what it is I'm going to write about when I sit down to write. The ideas are always generated by the writing process itself. So usually I'll begin with something very small, you know, something concrete that's grabbed my attention. It could be a bird calling or something that I've observed on a walk. It could even be a word or a phrase or a little run of syllables that strike me as interesting and intriguing. However, before I start committing anything to paper, I usually read poetry for about half an hour, and I read my favourite poets, the ones I know will always get me writing and the ones that remind me of why I love poetry and why I also wish to write. I also try to make sure that I'm calm and relaxed. I've never been able to write when frazzled or distressed or depressed. And I also know that if I have some time before me, I feel a sense of joy and of great good fortune. And I try to cultivate a sort of mild optimism, I suppose, when I enter the writing process. It's almost as if I have that feeling as if I was about to take a trip or a journey, not knowing quite where I'll end up. But also acknowledging too that to actually have a few hours to spend freely ranging around in the imagination, not to be beholden to anyone or to any imperative outside my own creativity and will to write, is a very privileged position, and many people do not have this opportunity. Because I write slowly, I've never been able to do much with half an hour or an hour. I never write on buses and trains or in the cracks. I've written poetry since I was 17 years old, and I've always made it my primary work. It's never been something I've just fitted into my spare time, because for me, it's the main game. It's what gets me up in the morning. I've only ever taken part-time jobs so that I could devote myself to writing. I only write indoors, in my study, which is a converted garage, with familiar things around me, my books, usually a scented candle or a stick of incense burning, my dog lying next to me on the couch before he gets up, fed up with me constantly going from the couch to the computer, realising that I'm not going to pay him enough attention. I also need absolute silence when I work, so I wear industrial strength headphones to shut out any noise. So for me, writing is work, and it's hard work. I'm not a natural, prolific or fluent writer. I struggle with poetry. I write word by word, line by line. I think I've probably only written about 4 or 5 poems in my whole writing life, which have taken me less than about 3 hours. I spend many days, weeks mostly, before I finish a poem. I've written a huge number of failures, poems which I simply could not make cohere or bring to satisfactory fruition. and I have many moments in writing where I get stuck. I simply don't know how to proceed or what to do next. At these times, I might stop and start to read poetry again. And I think one of the reasons that I continue to write poetry is because of its demanding nature, because of its difficulty. I'm always searching for a way to write a poem, and each poem is a fresh challenge, and each line written is searching for the next line. In recent years, I've taken advice from a comment that Wallace Stevens made, and he said that when you're writing a poem, it's necessary to get the intellect off the poem almost successfully. And he said one of the best ways to do this is to concentrate on the music of the poem. So during the writing process, I'll start to play with assonance and alliteration. And in these moments, I simply forget what it is I'm trying to say. I might take some lines that I've already written and look at the sound structure and try to develop a kind of pleasing musical pattern. And I find this works well for me. It gets my critical brain off the poem and it allows a sense of play into the writing process, and it helps also to generate content. And I think it takes me somewhere in the poem that I may not have arrived at otherwise. Usually the most difficult part for me in writing a poem is the ending. I really struggle with the endings, much more so than any other aspect. But the most enjoyable part is the editing for me, the cleaning up, the making sure that everything is in the right place, the right words, the right rhythm, the right form and structure, the right sounds. And it's going back to the poem again and again to try and find where those improvements can be made. I use the thesaurus and dictionary constantly. They're my favourite books in all the world, and quite often I just read them for the sheer joy of discovering new words and associations. But I think no matter how much we talk about the process, there's always something that remains inherently mysterious about creativity. No matter how sensuously or seriously or strenuously words may evoke the world, of course, they're never the world. There's always a gap between the world and the thing. And we know that the Greeks explained the magic of poetry through their muses, those nine goddesses that aided and inspired writers and musicians. The Christian and Renaissance writers had the idea of inspiration to explain the irrational, mysterious power of poetry. Inspiration, of course, from the Latin, to be breathed into. And the Romantics looked to the idea of genius. And the Spanish poet Federico García Lorca used the term duende to explain the mysterious power of art, a kind of energy that came not from the artist's conscious control, but from inside, from the very soles of the feet. And Dylan Thomas talked about the force that through the green fuse drives the flower. So I think poetry has always been one of the most powerful and effective forms for addressing and exploring deep human questions. And partly, I think this is because poetry is connected so intimately with the breath, much more so than other linguistic expressions. And it employs tools which enable both reader and writer to access truths in non-discursive ways. It uses lots of patterns and repeating structures such as rhythm and assonance and alliteration, occurrence of words, phrases and images. And these act as a kind of regulating mechanism, not only for the breath, but also, I think, for the movement of thought. The Irish poet Michael Longley has said something that's always chimed with me. He says that the poet makes the most complex and concentrated response that can be made with words to the total experience of living. For these reasons, I would go on trying to write poems even if no one wanted to read them. And I think I'm drawn to that statement of Longley's because it harks back to that statement that Keats made about poetry, that it is essentially about soul-making. And with a reference to this soul-making quality of poetry, Charles Wright has said that truly poetry is not a matter of arrangement of performance, of presentation, of rhetorical dazzle and surprise, although all those matters may be part of it. He said it's not the distractions but the focus. It's a question of what's in your life and where you want your life to lead you. You've only got one and you can fill it with whatever you want. If it is poetry that you want, then don't look for language games, intellectual rip-offs or rhetorical sing-alongs. It's too often a matter of life and death to those who really cared. You've got to know in your heart of hearts that Keats is right, that it is about soul-making, that does matter and that it can make or break you as a person. Looking back on my over 45 years now of writing, I think I've been able to learn some astounding things. Patience, diligence, how to be receptive, how to pay close attention to the world around me, how to develop brute persistence, how to fall in love with the possibilities of language. And I've learned much about my own inner resources and lack of. But above all, I've learned that the human imagination, that making capacity of the inner world, is worth a lifetime's dedication, and that it is the journey, the process, that's the most satisfying and significant, not any worldly success that may come one's way. Thank you.
That was Judith Beveridge. Alvin Pung is an award-winning poet and editor based in Singapore, featured in the Oxford Companion to Modern Poetry in English and the Penguin Book of the Prose Poem. His writing has been published in more than 20 languages. His most recent books are What Happened, Poems 1997 to 2017, and an Ipsy chapbook, Uninterrupted Time.
I was reflecting the other day when the National Library in Singapore came to my place to cart away essentially my old manuscripts and materials for the National Archives. And it struck me that I've been working on writing for the past 25 years now. I'm like, oh, has it been really that long? And I was thinking about what that meant. And I think today in particular, in front of everyone, I can probably describe it as, I've worked very hard to be lazy. And I'll talk a little bit about what that meant. But first of all, thank you very much for having me here again at Poetry on the Move, one of my favorite poetry festivals in the world, really, and I've been to quite a few. And it's nice to come back after a couple of years and sort of think about where I've moved and how I've evolved as a writer over the past couple of years. So a few years ago, I started a research project that had to do with thinking about my own creative practice as a person who does many different things. So I'm a poet, I've been a journalist, I do some work in public policy, I'm a curator, etc., etc. And I wanted to sit down and think about what that meant for me as a writer in particular. Even my writing has very frequently been described as restless, a label that I both sort of push back against, but also in a sense embrace as something quite fundamental to how I do what I do. So I've been thinking over the past few years what it means for me to write. When I started out, I guess, as a writer, I was, you know, as many of us do, following particular models. It was very much based on the sort of work I was reading, both as a student of literature in Singapore, as well as influences coming from worlds as diverse as music and video games and things like that. And I was, in a sense, trying to not exactly imitate, but to engage in conversation with the sorts of works, the sorts of texts that I had encountered and really enjoyed. It was almost as if I was sort of offering my own response, sometimes to fill in a gap in between responses. So you might, for example, have a poem about the sea by Alfred Lord Tennyson, which is the English Channel, sort of stormy grey sea, as in break, 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 on thy cold grey stones, etc. And pitted next to that might be some anonymous poem coming out of an anthology meant for students from the colonial tropics. And it was all about how life by the sea was all coconuts and planting rice and fishing and lazing under palm trees. And I remember thinking, I was a kid when I first started writing in response to these sorts of works, that the particulars of my sea and seaside were not visible. It was neither the sort of cold English channel, the emo sea, nor was it the super chill, hang loose, balmy breeze, tropics. It was something else entirely. And I felt compelled to sort of speak into that silence, as it were. And I realized that that's been a big part of what has drawn me. So in a sense, poetic process as a kind of answering to, answering back, answering into particular forms of silence. But also conversations. My readings, the writers I've really loved and enjoyed over the years, the Heaneys, the Whitmans, the Dickinsons, the Tomas Salomans, so on and so forth, the Wong Pui Nams from Malaysia. These are writers whose works might or might not have been prominent in a global sense. You know, they might or might not have won awards here and there. That wasn't the point for me. The point was whether they spoke to me and the particulars of my condition that I was thinking about. It might have been the way Wong Pui Nam, for example, talks about remembering his grandmother in particular, and the way in which family rumors became part of the fabric of family narratives and stories. And in a sense, the strength of the rumor was more compelling and more important than whether or not they were true, and how, in a way, those particular stories, fake news today we might call it, end up really coloring the relationships in particular families. I could really relate to that as a sort of Singaporean Asian family with very large and complicated interlinkages and so on. I grew up with two grandmothers on one side, and apparently on the other side, I'm a long, 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 multiple generation descendant of the Prophet Muhammad, apparently. Don't know what that means. And so speaking to these relationships, speaking to these connections, speaking in a conversational sense, adding myself to the conversation of what is, and later on, of course, with study and scholarship, to the larger conversation of the intellect, of literature, so on and so forth, has been a very big part of what's driven me in the early part of my writing career, so I thought. In the late 90s, early 2000s, where a big part of my work was about community building in Singapore, we didn't have a scene, as it were, as you might have called it. Today we do, but 20 years ago we didn't. And a lot of the work of being a poet in Singapore back in the late 90s was about building a community. I like to describe it as, I'm a race car driver, but there is no road to race on, so I had to build the racetrack first. And so much of the work was building the racetrack so I myself could run on it. But of course, in the process, you enable other people to come in and race and run as well. And so inevitably, the writing was not only inward-looking and internal to my own interests and concerns. It was also about speaking to community, a sense of sharing, a sense of building up, a sense of the collective, what it meant to have a collective voice. More recently, I think, and I might have been age, my work has moved more and more inward. I've become more and more drawn to the thinking of writers such as Tim Ingold, who thinks about writing as a way of mind walking. I find myself physically taking a lot of walks, usually when I feel stuck creatively. I find that the physical act of walking makes a difference to how the mind works. And I find myself, in a sense, more and more grounded in the movements of the body and in the way in which the writing process is, at a fundamental level, material. It's bound up in a confluence of everything that we are and we experience. And by that, I mean that, we think about writing as working with the material of language, but even language itself is a fluid, slippery substance. It doesn't sit still. The well-known very distinguished cultural medallion poet Lee Tzu Peng from Singapore on a panel at the Singapore Writers Festival a couple of years back once lamented that the beautiful word gay had been corrupted by contemporary poetry because of its entering into the sort of conversations about sexual orientation and so on. And of course, half the room was sort of soberly nodding, yeah, yeah, and the other half of the room were sort of about to start a riot. There was a healthy debate, thank goodness, but it really got me thinking about how even the words we think fix us and ground us, and you know, we imagine it gives us a sense of longevity, if not immortality, in the Shakespearean sense. Well, the words don't sit still, do they? Their meaning shift, the context shifts, and so on. And I found myself realizing that a lot of the work I was writing was colored literally by where I was, down to the temperature of the room, what I happened to have had that evening. You know, I might be thinking about or writing about the post-colonial condition and hybridity, and you know, something about how the mind is at work, but the body itself is rebelling against the imperial imperative of the brain and doing its own thing by being tired or going blind, as I am slowly, and thinking about how even those sort of very material physical experiences have started to color my process. And the difference is where I used to be a little more programmatic about it, I would sort of set up structures. Today, I'm going to write about, say, going blind. You know, I would be like four-line stanzas, et cetera, et cetera. Now I just let it go. I just let the words and the writing flow where it might, and then I think about it a little more. And I let particularly my process tell me where I'm going. So I'm sort of teaching myself by writing, and the poem itself becomes, instead of an outcome of process, becomes the process itself. And I consider myself having succeeded if I start out one way and I end up somewhere completely else with a particular insight or direction, good or bad, nice or not, elegant or not, if I end up somewhere I didn't intend to go when I started out. And probably run out of time at the moment, and thank you for listening.
That was Alvin Pung talking about poetry and process. Angela Gardner is the author of Parts of Speech, Views of the Hudson, The Told World, and Thing and Unthing. Her manuscript, Some Sketchy Notes on Matter, was shortlisted for the Dorothy Hewitt Award in 2018 and is published by Recent Work Press.
One of the things that Owen said was, what about an example of somebody else's process you'd like to adopt or tell the world about? And I thought about something that Tishani Doshi has said about how she writes a poem. And it's quite a long quote, but I'll read it to you and see what you think. Steal a first line if you must. After you've finished writing the poem, destroy that line or not. Newspapers can be a good source of inspiration or not. Handwrite preferably in turquoise ink or not. Worship words and keep a notebook filled with them or not. Memorize a poem you love or not. Understand that poetry is held in the body, that it works to a different kind of time and rhythm from prose words and news words, and figure out how to inhabit that time. You guessed it. Or not. Long walks may help, or not. Listen to Baudelaire, be drunk on wine or virtue, but be drunk, or not. Proceed, or not. And I thought the takeout for that was that there are lots of different approaches. There's lots of different ways of getting into poetry. I started reading poetry when I was a child. I was born in Wales, and you can't get away without having poetry, singing, and rugby as influences. I kept mostly the poetry. But lots of different experiences mean that there's lots of different ways to approach the writing of a poem, and to be open to all the kinds of poems that come up, because we're all different. It reminds me of Fred Williams, the Australian artist, saying what you needed to do to paint a landscape was to find the view and then turn your back on it and paint that that you decided you, you know, was the discard. So the opposite of what you thought you were going to do. So I do lots of ragbag bits of scrawlings in notebooks a lot of the time. I don't have always lots of time to write. I'm also a visual artist and I spend time in the studio. I deliberately carve out, maybe it's only one day a week that I can do it, but I deliberately go and carve out some time to do that. I didn't go to university to do English literature or any of those things. I went to art college, and the way that you learn in art college is by sitting in a studio making work, and maybe once a week somebody would come along and give you a crit. But in the meantime, you learnt that the thing to do was to make the work and then go and sit a long way back from it and smoke a cigarette while looking at it. I've given up the cigarettes, but you do need to have that distance to get back and look at things. So I think because of that visual art thing, the way I think about poems is almost like something solid, three-dimensional that you start with. So if you, you know, I'll write something and it will be what would seem to be prose, and that's fine. It's just a block, something. I mean, Michelangelo said that what he was doing when he was kind of knocking into bits of marble was he was trying to let out the thing that was already there. I never know, as you know, what it is that I'm trying to write about. I just start writing, it's a block of something, and then I'll do maybe some processes on it to get it, to get me to look at it in a different way. So one of the things I will do is to just say, okay, well, a lot of English iambic pentameter is sort of pretty much 10 syllables. You know, no, it isn't. We all know it's a little bit more to it than that. But yeah, it's about 10. So I'll just get that piece of text and I'll just chop it at the 10th thing and then get the next 10 and then the next 10, the next 10. And what it'll do is it'll make line breaks, which will then make you think of how things fit together a lot more. Then what I might do is I might just turn it on its head and I might sort of say, okay, the last line's going to be the first line. And again, that's getting to the point. Maybe it's not going to change anything in the middle of it, but it's going to change where the meaning breaks. And by trying to then look at what's trying to be said, it creates an action. It turns it from being sort of like something inert to something that's answering back at you. What else did I decide I was going to tell you about? Not sure. But all the time, I mean, one of the practice that I have as an artist is mostly as a printmaker, and that is a lot of that is line and texture, and I think that a poem, when you look at it, when you read it, you're looking at texture, and you're not just looking at, you know, yes, you're looking at, you know, assonance, consonance, dissonance, you're looking at things, at the thing that niggles at you, the thing that that doesn't seem right, and that's actually sometimes the big thing that actually makes it work. If it was all smooth, if it was all kind of, it wouldn't niggle at you. And I know that from visual art. You go and look at things and you think, you know, that really satisfies me, but it's the sort of thing I need to go back and look at again. I can't just, give it the 2 second gallery look. You know, you look at it 2 seconds and you move on to the next one. But there's some of those things you sort of go, what is it about that really niggles at me, really annoys me? And it's that bit that is the important bit, the bit that's, you know, the fray and the weave that really does make a difference. The other thing I'd say, as both Alvin said anyway, I think I don't know whether Judith said it. You don't always know what you're going to start off with. I think maybe both of you said that. But once you find that there is something in there, I feel that what I need to do is have that shimmering at the back of my head. Like it's not actually there. It's over here, and it's sort of nebulous, but you know it's there. So something can be happening here, but there's other stuff happening there. I'm not sure that this is going to help you in writing poetry, by the way. But this is how it feels to me, that that's what's happening. And I think that's because it's a process that I don't necessarily feel that I know. I certainly don't know where it's going. And I, you know, but it's something that, you know, that you've finished when you've sort of finished it. If you know, you know. You know when it's finished. You sort of say, oh yeah, okay, I don't need to look at that any longer. Once you've got to the point where you're sort of just changing a comma, you go, yeah, I think we've got there. I think we've got there now. So that's all I wanted to tell you.
That was Angela Gardner. Catherine Cole's seventh collection of poetry, Wayward, was published in June 2019. Her memoir, Look Both Ways, was released in 2018. Coles has received grants and fellowships from the NEA, the NEH, the NSF, and the Guggenheim Foundation. She is a distinguished professor at the University of Utah.
This is the kind of topic and conversation that actually makes me very nervous to address, partly because of what Angela said late in her talk, which is, I'm not at all sure that this is going to help you. And I was sitting over there thinking, nobody can help you, least of all me. So I have some prepared remarks, and then going last, you also end up with a few unprepared remarks as you go. The prepared remarks are called In Process, which, you know, would not surprise anyone. I was thinking while I was listening of the American poet Archie Ammons, who most of you probably don't know, but he's quite a wonderful poet, gone now. And he, in a taped interview with Alice Fulton, talked about the feeling of needing to write as a kind of anxiety or pressure that builds in the body. Literally in the body, and that the job of writing the poem for him is about moving that anxiety from in here to out there, where it can be seen and worked on and dealt with. And I think that because how this happens is so mysterious to us, we really do tend to think magically, not only about our own processes, but also about the processes of others. We want to know who writes at midnight and who at dawn on a clean desk or a cluttered desk on a yellow legal pad. It's like learning a spell or reading someone's personal diary, as if either will contain the secret to our own future success. I care about the processes of others in the way I care about exotic creatures, with bemused curiosity, maybe admiration or wonder. Bad news, good news. Process is in fact idiosyncratic, personal, and I would argue non-transferable. The good news is it changes over time. By the way, do you guys even have something called a legal pad over here? And if so, is it yellow? You do, because if you didn't, when I was younger, I could not have written a single line in Australia. Back then, I didn't understand what I called process as a set of habits turned superstitions. The legal pad had to be narrow ruled, the pen a black rollerball. I needed a 3-hour time block, minimum, at home, with my own books and a bed and a chair in my indoor jammies. We can talk about outdoor jammies some other time. Unlike others I know, especially women, I did not have to tidy up or do the dishes, one of my gifts being a perfect indifference to mess. I had to begin by reading, first poems, then often science. I'd gather notes, a quote or a stray line, bringing an idea into music to mark a beginning. Then I could write as long as I could on my yellow pad, incorporating phrases and lines from my notes. I'd stutter to a stop. I would strike things, shift things, add lines, begin again on a new page for a few minutes, a clean copy. Reach something like an end. Repeat. Then, because this was the olden days, I would take the poem to the typewriter, a huge step because I am a terrible typist. Mark up the typescript, shake the thing back into longhand, repeat. Every time after an unreasonable number of drafts, I would realize that I needed to cut the first third of the poem right off the top, every time. I was finished when I had finally laboriously excised the last extravagant hand ring of what I called my inner Victorian maiden, who liked to emote in high diction. With my first book, I added final corrections in pencil to every copy I ran across in a bookstore. Talk about taking a long time to write a poem. Fast forward. A decade ago, I was getting a poetry think tank up and running in Chicago, where I hotel camped 1 week a month, and I was still teaching at my university position. Given airplanes, hotel rooms, and two jobs, you might think I'd have set poems aside, but I catapulted instead into a whole new zone of productivity. Why? Well, first, preciousness about books and jammies notwithstanding, an airplane seat is the very best place on earth to write poems. The stranger in the next seat assiduously ignores you, especially if you're muttering to yourself. And from time to time, somebody comes along and gives you a drink. Secondly, being a stranger somewhere, anywhere at all, is a poem-generating machine, putting you in an unaccustomed relationship both to the world and to yourself, in which your sight sharpens as does your dreaming. In fact, speaking only for myself, almost any place at all, a city street, a museum, a hotel bed, the lakefront where you run, a bare office where you keep only your snow boots in the filing cabinet, makes a better place for writing than home, which, even if you're indifferent to mess, is full of distractions and people who want things from you. During these 2 years spent writing on the fly, culminating in a visit to Antarctica on a U.S. National Science Foundation grant, the membrane between my poetry mind and my everyday mind dissolved. Now I work on poems in my car, to the detriment of my driving, on my bicycle, which I keep falling off of. When writing a poem, my Buddhist friend says, write a poem. When riding a bicycle, etc. In the shower, running, doing the dishes, falling asleep. And I think this is like Alvin's inwardness, the turning inward. To me, it feels like a kind of receptivity. While I'm reading, I write poems while I'm reading, in faculty meetings, in conference sessions, probably sitting in this room listening to somebody else. I'll be doing that. These days, I do skip the unnecessary opening lines and I banish the Victorian maiden as I go. So why the change? Necessity, obviously, but I also think I was just ready, enabled by my early obsession with making things just so, which is not only, it turns out, a form of magical practice, it's a way of making sure to do the work when what the work is and how it might get done aren't clear yet. It doesn't matter how you do it, only that you do it. Do you guys know Malcolm Gladwell? Over here. So he proposed, perhaps randomly, that it takes 10,000 hours of work to master a skill. Process, to me, however we configure it, is how we get the hours in and how we hone our craft. And then what, at least as a conscious thing, we, if we're lucky, get to leave behind. At the moment it really begins to work for you, you may be able just to stop caring about it, to move from the just work of it all into fluidity, where process adjusts itself in the moment, hewing to a poem as it forms, specific and unique.
That was Catherine Coles talking about poetry and process. And that ends this episode of the Poetry on the Move podcast. Thanks to Catherine, Judith Beveridge, Angela Gardner, and Alvin Pung. This panel was motivated by Owen Bullock's ongoing research project, Poetry in Process, and you can find more about this, including interviews with a number of poets, at poetryinprocess.com. This podcast is made possible by IPSI, the International Poetry Studies Institute, in the Centre for Creative and Cultural Research, Faculty of Arts and Design at the University of Canberra. My name is Shane Strange. Thank you for listening.